Hello, I'm Jane Crowe, the editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And our production editor, Erlinga Einarsson. Did I do it right?
Yes, full marks.
This week we're checking out zombie action, Army of the Dead, Billy Piper's Rare Beasts, literary coming of age of my New York year, and footy documentary, Alex Ferguson, Never Give In. But before we start on those, what has everybody been watching this week? What have you been feasting your eyes on, Erlinga?
I've been watching Shadow and Bone on Netflix, the fantasy series. It's developed by Eric Heisserer, who is also involved in The Witcher. He's adapted this series from like a series of novels by Leigh Bardugo, if I remember that correctly. It's kind of a Russo-centric fantasy, which is a fresh little touch. So it's based on both Russian myths and more than a little hint at like the Iron Curtain and all of that. So there's this world that's split in two by what's called the Fold, and our heroine evidently has the powers to destroy the Fold and unite the world again.
I hate the sound of this. This is so not my thing.
I'm enjoying it immensely. It's
you
very
like
pulpy.
A bit of fantasy, don't you?
Yeah. It's a bit pulpy. There's a strong YA feel to it all, yeah. But it sips along at a very, you know, very healthy clip. I like the visuals. The costumes are ornate and glorious. The archetypes are entertaining.
Is it filling your Game of Thrones hole, as it were?
Yeah, well, it's more of a Witcher hole now as I'm waiting for the second season of that. But yeah, it fills that gap for me.
Cool.
At the moment.
Matthew, what are you watching?
I'm watching lots of animation across various platforms.
Why?
So I've watched The Mitchells versus The Machines on Netflix, Invincible, Mark Miller TV series on Amazon, Star Wars The Bad Batch on Disney Plus. And back to Netflix, She-Ra and the Princesses of Power.
Quite the selection. Yeah.
Got eyes on everything.
Very good. I haven't been watching very much this week because I've been watching waves lapping at shores in Cornwall. I went to Cornwall for the weekend.
Real life,
but sort of booked it before they then said you would be able to eat in restaurants on Monday. So I spent most of it eating nice dinners under an umbrella in a cagoule. Which felt extremely
British,
isn't it? So it felt like a good old-fashioned holiday. But
holiday.
I also did, obviously, I think I'm sure a lot of people did watch the fifth episode of Mayor of Easttown, which was a bit of a shocker and culminated in an explosive confrontation with a certain baddie. And then I've just watched next week's episode, which just takes it to another level of wonderful. I love this show. It's so good. I want it to run for longer. It's only 7 episodes and I'll be very sad when it's gone. But those are my recommendations. Shall we have a look at what we've been watching, though, in the last few nights in preparation for what's coming out this week?
Lads.
Ready to lock and load with this.
There's $200 million in the vault beneath the strip. With a 32-hour window to get it out. Find the safe. This should be a simple in and out.
It's not too late to go back.
What the?
This is Army of the Dead. Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead. Tell us about it.
Was it a month after Zack Snyder's Justice League, which was ran for 4 hours? We get this slip of a film, which only runs 148 minutes. So, I mean, just a breeze.
That's very brisk. Very, very brisk by comparison.
Blink and you'll miss it. So this is Zack Snyder's return to zombies. He started his career with a remake of Dawn of the Dead, but he's back now with more zombies. And this time it's kind of a blend with a heist movie. The basic setup being that Las Vegas has been walled off because it's been completely overtaken by zombies. However, there's a Japanese businessman who's missing a few billion dollars, which are stored in the basement of one of the hotels. So he hires a crack team headed up by Dave Bautista to go and retrieve the money, basically. So Dave and his crew set off. He assembles this quite enormous crew. I mean, there's a huge amount of characters in it. And then they head into Vegas And as you'd imagine, there's all sorts of jeopardy and mishaps going on, and zombie tigers, zombie kings and queens. Mm-hmm. So an awful lot of splattery action going on before they can get this money.
But the zombies are slightly different, aren't they, Erlinger? The zombies are a little bit more evolved.
Yeah, you know, you got your basic zombie mythology there, but there's an added layer of that some of the zombies seem to be able to organize and control the rest of the brain-eating horde. You have your old-school, slow, ambling brains zombies, and then you have your, you know, super strong, super fast runners, and they have a sort of a hierarchy among themselves with the queen and the king, sort of. That's where the sort of interest lies within the zombie mythology of it.
But does the interest lie there? Did you like it? Oh, it's, that was a pregnant pause, wasn't it? As he collects his thoughts.
So checking your brain at the door is a reductive phrase. It's used for films that aren't, quote, intellectually stimulating. But a film that ticks that box still needs to engage your brain in some other way. You know, like the Fast and the Furious films, they are, you know, prime check your brain at the door stuff, because they don't have a lot of smarts or any sense whatsoever. But they fill that rather sizable gap, you know, with over-the-top visuals, outrageous stunts, otherworldly vehicles, oversized set pieces. And then it's all packaged in this, like, tried and tested package of emotional stakes centered around family. And Army of the Dead goes for a similar approach, the plot element of zombies having that hierarchy, and you have the sort of organizing element of that, but that's hardly Blade Runner level world building. Snyder goes for the approach of spectacle with emotion, and there are family connections, there are budding friendships within the group of mercenaries, and there's a subplot involving a missing mother to create some sort of emotion. And it's clear that Snyder is attempting to paint a portrait here, but the problem, it's being painted with crayons.
Oh.
None of it really resonates with you. It's all very, very used. Yeah, yeah, it's very disposable, and very rehashed in terms of the archetypes. The family connection, it all goes through a really cliched process. I did like the dynamic between some characters, especially the Jarhead Beefcake Vandero, who's played by Omari Hardwick, and the Safecracker Dieter, who was played by a very spirited Matthias Weichhofer.
Yeah,
I
like
those. Yeah.
Yeah, they were good, weren't they? And weirdly, the biggest appeal for me was, in terms of the characters, was Tig Notaro's Marianne, who plays like a helicopter pilot for hire. And I say weirdly because she was cast very, very, very last minute. Well, as a replacement for, it was Chris D'Elia, wasn't it? And he's facing trial for sexual misconduct at the moment. And she shot all her scenes separately from the rest of the cast. You know, she never met any of the other cast, and there were body doubles standing in for her, and she was just in front of a green screen. But she is really the emotional core of that film for me. She has that, you know, spunk to her character, and you really care about her, and it's kind of damning for the rest of the film for me, because it all falls flat and it's way overlong. It's 80 minutes of plot stretched out over 2.5 hours.
Matthew, what did you think?
Yeah, similar. Yeah, I found it very overstuffed and didn't seem to know when to stop. But then it stops very abruptly. Seems to like finish in the middle of a scene. I mean, I don't know. I guess it's a setup for a potential sequel. But yeah, I found the ending quite dissatisfying. There was quite an amount I enjoyed in it. I mean, I think Snyder does a really good slow motion opening montage, as we've seen, even in Batman v Superman. I mean, I can't stand the rest of the film, but the opening montage is good.
And he's very good at openings. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a good one here where it's all very sort of flamboyant and outrageous, but I didn't really feel like it built on that very much. It's not kind of much satirical kind of punch to the film. Just too many characters. They really should have just boiled it down to a few more. It kind of spreads itself too thin.
You mentioned Blade Runner there. It's impossible not to think of Blade Runner because they're obviously in Las Vegas. Mm. And then you're sort of, oh God, that one's better. But also I found it impossible not to think of Suicide Squad and my anticipation for James Gunn's version that's coming up. How much I think he's going to be able to juggle that many characters, but also put in, you know, wit and emotion and real sort of arc satisfaction. Whereas this, for me, if we're talking about zombies, this was one of the shamblers, wasn't it, really? It's just sort of shambling along, and it's just not as exciting as if it was running. But if you're a Snyder fan, it does have all of those elements that you look for in his sort of movies, all of those Snyder touches. So I guess if you like his work, then this is something that will be a good popcorn treat for a weekend. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, some of the effects are a little bit ropey, like the zombie tiger. I was so looking forward to the zombie tiger. I mean, that was really going to be the MVP for me. But yeah, I was a little bit let down by that. But otherwise, you know, it's got this huge scale to it. Loads of action set pieces, some quite elaborate, ambitious. I mean, yeah, it feels like a blockbuster. It feels like a sort of blockbuster we haven't seen for a while, even though it is on Netflix. So it's a big, fat Snyder movie. So if you like big, fat Snyder movies, you'll enjoy it.
Okay, so that big fat Snyder movie is hitting Netflix this weekend. I suggest popcorn and a massive Coke. If you're still not getting back to the cinema, this is, you know, it's a version of it, isn't it? Shall we move on then from zombie hordes to a mother stumbling through life with this?
So are you single, Pete?
I find women intolerable.
Right.
I'm going to go home and whack over your Instagram pictures, okay? But only the ones with your mouth closed.
Welcome to my life. How long are you staying for?
Indefinitely. We should go and watch people being happy.
Every wife, respect your husband!
So this is Rare Beasts. This is Billy Piper's directorial debut, but also written by her and starring her. Didn't write the theme tune, but might as well have done.
There is music in it though, isn't there?
Yeah, and she's got pipes. She could have put one of her little singles on there, but she didn't. But yeah, this is definitely a sort of real love letter and sort of feels very sort of close to things she might have experienced in her life. Erlinger, who does this centre on?
Well, it centres on Mandy, who's a career-driven single mum, and Pete, who's a more, let's say, traditionalist, religious, and quite temperamental man who she falls in love with against her better judgment. They stumble their way through confrontational dates, awkward family meets. Pete's struggle to deal with Mandy's son's peculiarities and their vastly different views on almost every aspect of life. Yeah, that's pretty much what you get in the film, isn't
it? Yeah, and you know, you can't help but sort of wonder if Pete is based on someone that she may have been with in the past. A traditionalist man that says controversial things and seems to hate women and is anti any sort of woke brigade. It feels kind of familiar to anyone that's been following the recent mayoral race in London. Did you like it? I mean, it is quite confrontational in terms of what she's throwing out there. How did you feel about it, Matthew?
Yeah, I went back and forth with it. There were some moments I just found just too jarring and on the nose. Yeah, and quite difficult to watch. Other moments I thought it was really bold and hilarious and ambitious. Throughout the film, I just went back and forth. I feel like it's one you'd need. I mean, I wouldn't watch it again too soon, but I feel like it's one you would need multiple viewings to really kind of make your mind up about it. But I mean, it's certainly a bold directorial debut. It wasn't quite what I was expecting. I mean, all the kind of expressionist flourishes going on in there. I liked all the performances. I thought were really strong, especially Kerry Fox and David Thewlis as her parents. They have this kind of subplot running throughout the movie. I delighted in them every time they turned up. So I certainly enjoyed those aspects of it.
Yeah, they're both quality, aren't they?
Mm. Did either of you watch I Hate Susie?
Billy, no, but I've heard comparisons to it. Yeah.
It feels very much of a companion piece to that, in as much as she is not afraid to write or perform a character that you don't necessarily like or agree with or even root for in some cases. You know, they're both quite chaotic characters. And I think that's, as you say, you mentioned the word bold, Matthew. I think although this isn't quite there, it's so bold and so interesting and just doesn't care really about whether you do like it. And that's quite interesting. You know, there's a moment where she's walking down the street and smiling because she's happy, and a builder goes past and says, "What are you smiling for? You look like the Joker, love." And it taps into that idea of what society keeps expecting of women. And, you know, the character that she is going out with has expectations of what a woman is, what a wife is, what a girlfriend is. People say to her, "I bet you're great in bed." It really is quite a feminist film, don't you think?
Yeah, oh, totally, yeah. Especially that final scene as well.
It reminds me, you know, another film that obviously came out recently that sort of had this sort of idea of, look, women are not here to be what you want them to be. They are complex individuals. Promising Young Woman, it sort of feels like a companion piece to that.
I felt like the expectation of, you know, strong, independent woman should be like Billie Piper's character doesn't want to follow that at all times. And those scenes for me were quite interesting as well, because as you say, everyone in this film is hard to like.
Yeah.
You know, they're all bitter and cynical and they're all masking their crippling self-doubt. So
which
even
is real
this,
life.
Yeah. And there's a fair bit of experimentation in it as well, yeah. Like stylistic, visual experimentation. Sometimes it worked really well for me, and sometimes I found it a little bit jarring and distancing, you know, when it should have been drawing me in. I agree with a lot of what both of you are saying. And I really like Billie Piper's like fearless approach to playing a character who has overt flaws. And I also have to give a shout out to Toby Wolf, who is brilliant as the son, who is, you know, quote, difficult. He's implicitly somewhere on the autistic spectrum, even though that's never quantified in the film. Every scene with him I found was electric. Again, like you said, Matthew, David Thiel is really solid throughout the film.
It reminded me of Naked. Maybe it was because of Fewless being in it, but it did kind of remind me of Mike Leigh's Naked in terms of this kind of modern portrait of making your way through London life. That just kept coming, you know, and that very sort of jagged, scabrous edge to it. So it did remind me of that quite a few times.
But it is also really funny in places. I mean, this disastrous date that she goes on with this guy, and, you know, she eats too much and she throws up, and he tells her he's going to go home and sort of masturbate over her Instagram, but with her mouth closed. And there's some absolutely corking lines of dialogue in it. And then I really love there's a point where they go to this obnoxious wedding with Lily James playing this sort of boho bride. And it's just a perfect cameo. Lily, I loved it. So good. We've all been at places like that where she's standing in this wedding going, what is going on? Because it's this ridiculous scenario of this falseness of this wedding on this particular day. Within that, there's this dancing scene that is just reminded me of Another Round, in that sort of cutting loose and expressing yourself through dance and almost finding the real you in letting yourself go to a crappy disco tune. So there's so much going on in it and so many interesting things that I do think a lot of people would find something in it to enjoy.
And it has a brilliant acoustic piano version of the Chemical Brothers' Swoon. So.
It does. It does. The music is very good. I love the music as well. Certainly isn't a date movie, is it? Don't go on
a first date movie.
Don't go on a first date with this one. Although it would give you plenty to talk about afterwards. You wouldn't be stuck for conversation. And also, yeah, as you said, there's stylistically some things that don't quite work, and it feels a little bit like she tried to do too much and maybe could have reined some of those aspects in. But overall, I just think it's a really impressive debut, and I just can't wait to see what she does next with that, where she goes with her writing and her directing.
Agree.
Okay, so we will recommend that. Rare Beasts, just don't go on a date with it. That is out in cinemas. You can go and see it on a big screen. Off your bob. Amazing. Right. It is now time to test your film nerd powers.
Oh, my gosh.
It's time for alternative line reading. Last week, Jamie knocked it out the park with something truly terrifying. We're ready for Erlinger's now. Let's go, Erlinger.
Okay, so I've got a dialogue scene. Except one of them is a Norwegian and the other one is Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wait a minute. Are you going to do it in Norwegian?
No, he is. He's got a Norwegian accent.
Okay, because you can speak Norwegian, can't you?
Very basic conversational, yes.
But yeah, but I think that's. I think we're beyond trying that. I don't think Matthew and I are going to be any good at that, but go for it.
I did consider doing one where I just translated the whole thing into Icelandic, but that would have been possible.
I'd like to hear that version too, but go ahead.
And now it is time to go back. I know, to hell. You know nothing. Hell is only a word. The reality is much, much worse. Let me show you.
Oh, hell is only a word.
Is it Jingle All the Way? So Arnold.
Yeah. Is it another parent trying to get hold of a toy? And that's what
it does sound like that, doesn't it? Does sound
right.
like Christmas
so
shopping.
So the other person is actually Norwegian in this film.
No.
You've just done it in that style.
I just did it in that style, yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Is it End of Days?
It's not End of Days. And it's not actually Arnold Schwarzenegger. I just changed the actor in the scenario to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I was racking my brain.
So now, hell is only a word. Let me show you.
Yeah.
Is it Event Horizon?
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah!
It goes to Jane.
It is time to go back.
I know. To hell.
You know nothing. Hell is only a word. The reality is much, much worse.
Who doesn't love Event Horizon with eyes pulled out of skulls and
I
Sam
watch it
Neill.
Every year.
Sam Neill.
Sam Neill. That was, yes, Event Horizon.
I would never have got that.
God, that was hard. That was really hard. Okay.
You set a high bar there.
That is a high bar. We'll have to see what we get next week for alternative line reading. Okay, shall we move on then to 90s New York? With this.
Writers make the worst assistants.
Get to work.
There were hundreds of us working at literary agencies or publishing houses. We wanted to be writers ourselves.
You're a novelist yourself?
Joanna is my assistant. I don't hire writers.
Guess who my boss represents?
And Rice?
The Pope, Thomas Pynchon.
J.D. Salinger.
No way!
Salinger?
So, Matthew, this was called... Hello. My Salinger year in America, but apparently us Brits are too stupid to understand who Salinger
who
is. So they changed it to my New York year. Salinger in it? Tell us.
He is and he isn't. I mean, I don't know, spoilers, obviously, but yes, it's a reference to the author, Catcher in the Rye, author J.D. Salinger, who is kind of a background figure to this movie, because the main character is a young college student called Joanna, played by Margaret Qualley. And she gets a job at a literary agency, which is overseen by Margaret, played by the formidable Sigourney Weaver. And their most famous client is the author J.D. Salinger. But as he was in real life, quite an elusive character. He only rings up every now and again. We don't see him really in the flesh. But Joanna kind of gets more and more intrigued by him and particularly by the people who write to him, because they get piles and piles of letters which have to be very carefully vetted because of Mark Chapman, who famously shot John Lennon carrying a copy of Catcher in the Rye. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. This is all about Joanna's kind of negotiating this new world of work and her new boss, but also trying to work out exactly what she wants to do with her own literary aspirations. And there's her romantic life thrown into the mix. So there's quite a lot going on. I should say it's all set in the mid-90s. I had no idea where it was set. I thought it was like the mid-50s, but it turned out it was 1995. So that kind of threw me for a loop a bit when they start talking about computers and the internet.
It is based on a book by someone who actually lived this life and did work at an agency that dealt with famous authors. It's a sort of coming of ager based on real biography. It sort of feels a little Devil Wears Prada in its sort of relationship between Margaret and Joanna. That's mildly entertaining, but really I don't know who it's aimed at, because it's sort of a bit rom-com-y, but not. A bit about the pursuit of how to write a book and how to devote yourself to prose. It's about, you know, as you say, sort of working with a dragon of a boss, and Sigourney's wearing the hell out of pearls and cardies. Have you ever seen a woman wear a cardi so fashionably and wonderfully as Sigourney in this film? And then, you know, Douglas Booth turning up as this just horrible boyfriend. What am I rooting for here, I guess, is what I'm asking. When I watched this, I didn't know what I was supposed to be yearning for from it. Did you, Erlinger? Did you know where you were going with it?
No, it all felt really listless to me. There is, you know, that stylistic period assurance. And I am shocked, shocked that the 90s, which I'm sure happened no more than about 10 to 12 years ago, is now period drama.
Period.
That's something I'll have to... learn to live with. It's all really, you know, the hipster relationship drama is too identikit to really move you. You know, the scenes of agency life, they're held up entirely by Sigourney Weaver and, you know, how she so easily, you know, inhabits this matriarchal disciplinarian who's like kind of mean, but really she's good. You know, there's a lot of Devil Wears Hardback in this, really. It passes you by. You know, it passed me by. It's just too twee. It's trying to be quirky, but doesn't really transport you to the era. You're observing it rather than experiencing it, for me, at least.
Yeah, and it's also curious that it's about finding your voice in terms of literature and learning about what you want to write about, but no real sort of celebration of literature. We don't really see this girl writing this poetry that she's so passionate about, or see her inspired to write the poetry. She just seems to be going through life and having things happen to her. And she doesn't have much agency herself, even though she works in a agency. As you say, just sort of like a leaf blown in the wind. And I almost feel like I'm glad they took the Salinger out of the title, which they probably did because they thought we wouldn't understand it. But equally, that's not really what it's about. He is just a foil in this weird coming of age that doesn't really move or transport.
No, just pull in many different directions. Yeah, it kind of felt like an episode of Mad Men, but not a particularly memorable episode of Mad Men.
Where you're like, oh, I don't think I've seen this when it's on late at night. And you watch it and halfway through you go, oh, no, I have seen it. So unremarkable. And what about Margot Qualley? I mean, this is obviously the daughter of Andy McDowell, and she was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Do you reckon she's going places? I was sort of a little worried for her. I didn't know that this part was doing things for her.
There's promise there, isn't there? You know, and the scenes with Sigourney are quite strong, but is that just Sigourney Weaver lifting everyone around her up because she has that innate power in her performance? I don't know. The character as it was written wasn't doing Margaret Qualley any favours.
No.
So that is My New York Year. Watch it if you enjoy typewriters, I would say. There's a lot of typewriter porn in it. I mean, if you like the feel of a hard key and the replacement of a ribbon, it's going to do it for you.
Hate computers.
Yeah. That is out this weekend at cinemas. Okay, so let's move on to Plain Talking, where we demystify the stuff people say on set and in film. This week, we're talking about cans. Do you want some cans? What are they saying, Matthew?
They're saying, do you want some headphones so you can listen in to the action as it takes place?
Yes.
Feel like you're actually part of the crew.
You feel quite cool because you have them around your neck, don't you, like crew members?
Yeah.
And that's important to note as well, we should say, that there is can etiquette on a film set. Because the actors are mic'd up at all times, your etiquette is that when they're not acting, you put them around your neck and don't listen, because otherwise you could catch them gossiping or going to the toilet or whatever if they don't switch off their mic. So you have them on and off your ears. But this is also part of Video Village, which we've discussed before. So you're sitting there watching the action on the monitors and you need a bit of sound. Put your headphones on. So if someone shouts, put your cans on, you know what they're saying.
You were saying about you have to be discreet with them. I did hear some spoilers when I was on a Marvel film when they gave us some cans. There was some spoilery dialogue in my ear. I mean, you know, a year ahead of release. So that was quite a treat.
Was it like Robert Downey Jr. just going, and then I do a snap and like everyone comes back?
I think it was Thor. I seem to remember it was Thor threatening someone, something like that. But yeah, that was very thrilling to hear actual dialogue from the movie, which I wasn't supposed to be hearing. So.
Very good. That reminds me of when I was on Thor The Dark World, they said, you know, a character dies in this, a quite main character, we won't tell you who. But then we went into the workshop and lying on a deathbed, Body of Frigga was just lying there. And I was like, I think we might know who's dying. It's so good when you go on a set and you get those things and you know you can't tell anybody.
You have to sit on it for a year.
On it for a year until you put it on the cover. And even then you can't say anything. And you have to sit in the screening with your colleagues. And when they go, oh no, you're like,
I knew that.
Great times. Okay, so we've all got our cans on now. Let's move on to our next film. Is it a red card for this one?
You've got this reputation as this fearsome character.
Absolutely.
He knew exactly what I needed. It's why I worked so hard.
If he wanted you to be the proper manager, you have to know them all these different stories. This is the place where they've created gods.
That's Alex Ferguson, Never Give In, the documentary of the legendary football manager. What do we find out about him in this, Erlinger?
This is an intimate portrait of Sir Alex Ferguson. Most people will know was the manager of Manchester United and Aberdeen before that. It's mainly a first-hand account of Alex's life from his working-class youth through his playing career, early glory years with Aberdeen, and all the way through his epic reign at Manchester United. It frequently cuts back to his working class background, and more importantly, to his family and his recovery from a serious brain hemorrhage he suffered in 2018. It's directed by Alex's son, Jason. As such, it offers a real invite into the mind and the soul of this fascinating character that Alex is. If we are to compare it to another recent sports documentary I watched for this very same podcast, Pelé, this never shies away from its darker side. Unlike Pelé, which it felt more like a brand enhancement exercise, I thoroughly enjoyed it despite my strong anti-Man U stance.
Yes. Matthew, did you enjoy it? I mean, are you a fan of Sir Alex before this? Did this open up your eyes to him?
Well, I know very, very little about football. I know it's a game of two halves, but beyond that, I know zilch, really. I thought it was well put together. I would have liked a few more talking heads, really, because, yeah, you do get his family, but it's quite limited in terms of the ex-players who turn up. There's some interesting stuff from Ryan Giggs and Eric Cantona. But I felt like I wanted a bit more of a rounded portrait of him from the outside, and there's no pundits in it, as far as I can remember. But, yeah, with all the stuff where he's talking about, I mean, he suffered a brain hemorrhage in 2018. He feared that he'd be losing his memory and he can't actually remember the incident itself. I mean, all that's quite poignant and moving. And it gets into some stuff about his domestic life as well, which I felt it maybe glossed over a little bit, where they say about his wife effectively raised his three children, that he wasn't really there.
Yeah, wasn't home for, too busy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they sort of note that and then kind of moved on. But it was well put together. You know, as someone who doesn't really follow football or know much about it, I did get quite invested in it.
But because it's directed by his son, does it go far enough with its critical eye? Or, I mean, you do mention earlier that it's not brand enhancement, but is it critical enough?
I thought it was quite eye-opening because it didn't shy away from, you know, his temper. It didn't shy away from his regrets over not seeing his family enough at times. It also confronts, you know, falling outies with some of his players. There's like a chapter where following his early career at Manchester United and he had signed his goalkeeper from Aberdeen because he was the best goalkeeper in Scotland and possibly the best in the whole of the UK at the time. And he was really struggling that season. So he dropped him for the FA Cup replay. There's just archive footage of that goalkeeper, Jim Leighton. And then we understand why there's not an interview because Alex says he never spoke to me again. He still confronts it. He still talks about it. He realizes that he hurt him on a deep personal level. And there's also another scene where his son recalls chewing Alex out when he was at his darkest point in those same early years, you know, in front of his family. And it also looks at like how he confronts his recovery from the brain hemorrhage, you know, him sitting there looking disbelievingly at like a log of him trying to regain his memory, that his brain seemed to be that broken, and you see the brave exterior mask fall a bit, and he talks about his fear of dying, and it all felt very intimate. And I think it may have been an intentional decision, Matthew, to not bring in too many outside voices because it felt like it was an inside account throughout. So bringing in, you know, Gary Lineker or someone who isn't intimately involved with his daily life, it would have widened the scope, certainly, but maybe it would have diminished the personal impact of this account, which is firsthand entirely throughout.
Because this is an account of what effect on your life having a job like that has, really, isn't it? And how that day-to-day works rather than his place in cultural history, I suppose. So from that point of view, you don't want to be sort of contextualizing him in culture. You're basically getting inside what it would be like to be Alex Ferguson. And from that point of view, I think we're saying they did a pretty good job.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, so are we recommending this for football fans and non-football fans?
I'm recommending it definitely for football fans and enthusiastically for you know, documentary fans and people interested in the lives of extraordinary people.
The interior life of people we often watch on telly and know nothing about, or perhaps shout at through the telly. So that is Alex Ferguson, Never Give In. That's available in cinemas and on Prime Video. So take your pick on how you view that. So that's all we have time for this week. You know, we're getting back to the cinemas. Have you been to a cinema yet, boys? Have you had a go at sitting in the dark with a big screen and other people?
Not yet. We've got Peter Rabbit 2 lined up for the weekend.
Oh, yeah. I'm way ahead of you there, Matthew. Went on.
Oh, you've seen it already. No spoilers.
Yeah, Yeah. Went on Monday. It was my son's 5th birthday then, and we celebrated with a family trip, sitting inside a restaurant and then sitting inside a cinema, and it was glorious.
Yeah, I went yesterday, and I'm going to a screening this lunchtime to sit with real people and have that lovely sound and turn my phone off and not have interruptions. It's such a delight.
We missed it.
Yeah. So before we go, it's time for a reader's question. Are you ready? If you had to pick one film that explained who you were as a person and you had to explain to an alien, this is me, this is everything, what film would it be? Matthew?
Any of the SpongeBobs, I think. I mean, just pick, pick any of them. Really. That'd do it.
You have a soggy bottom and you have a starfish friend.
Yes, interpret as you will.
Okay. Yeah. Erlinger.
I agonized over this question all last night. I ended up just asking my wife what film explained me as a person, and she thought for about 3 milliseconds before saying Independence Day, which means I'm big, bombastic, and not too beholden to scientific reality.
But also a classic. A much imitated classic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mine would probably be Bridesmaids, because I feel like I am all of those women at some point or another. Yes.
I'm just gonna say one word. You can say yes or no. Sink.
No, I have never done that in a sink, thankfully. But, you know, there's still time, and there are still, you know, Brazilian restaurants to eat at where you could get a bit of food poisoning and that could happen. But yeah, in terms of the women that they are, I think it's one of those films that really does show the different facets of women, but also the friendship of women. And, you know, who hasn't sung a Wilson Phillips song with your friends shouting, singing that? So that's absolutely mine. Indeed. Okay, so that's it for this week. There is still an issue of Total Film on sale with a shark on the cover, if you haven't got it yet. And we will be coming out with a new issue on the 28th of May. So look out for that one. It's a cheeky one. But for now, shall we say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Is it really fair to feel this way inside? Change, things will go.